What's the most present thing for you right now?
The most present thing right now? I suppose trying to live in a pandemic is very much present in my mind. And trying to see beyond it and realizing I can't quite see beyond it, that it's a bit of an abysmal trench that we are crossing. So that I think is very much on my mind. It's very much what I'm writing about right now, in as much as I am writing, and that is that's what's present. I look back at some of the things I've been writing over the last few years, and realizing what a luxury I had, feeling so deeply connected to a place, its people, and then having suddenly uprooted myself, moved across the mountains here back to Montana, and this pandemic hitting and sort of alienating us all from one another. I think that is very much at the forefront of my mind right now.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, speaking with poet and essayist David Axelrod about his book, The Eclipse I Call Father, Essays on Absence. Don't go away. I'm really looking forward to exploring absence and presence in relation to the current pandemic. And I want to start by referring to the text that's in front of me, which is your book titled The Eclipse I Call Father, Essays on Absence. And you play throughout the book with these absences and losses. And the second essay, David, is called Accretions of Absence. And I want to talk about that intersection because I tend to think of accretions as having substance, you know, as sort of a buildup of something rather than a nothing. And I want to know what accretions of absence feel like to you, and what do they contain?
That's a nice question. That's very much what was on my mind, especially in that essay. Things that are not immediately present to our awareness, the surface of things, hide them. And yet, things are there. The past is there. History is there. We're living out here just east of town, where there was once a Chinatown. And one doesn't have to look far to find the presence of people who are no longer here, who are absent in the moment, but who nevertheless are here. Their material culture is here. The ditches, the irrigation ditches they dug, etc., etc. One can, of course, also talk about the history of the centuries before that and what is present but largely unseen or ignored, but still inflects our world everywhere. It's something, you know, I think I say in that essay that one feels keenly when one is living abroad. But what is it about coming home and living in a familiar space that blinds us to these kinds of depths of presence? And for me, it's learning to see all the accretions of the past and to see maybe time in a way that is free of what, you know, you might call consumptive time. That is, you know, the sort of neoliberal arrangement that orders our daily lives. And trying to see outside of that And so that's something I think is very much on my mind. The other day I was just checking on something behind the house, and we have a massive amount of rocks here. And I saw something I had never seen before. And I picked up what I guess is a piece of sort of pinkish quartz that is in the process of calving another stone from its core. And so there are two fractures along the side and a fracture through the middle. And the stone is coming loose. You can see light through the stone, behind the stone, but it is still so tightly pinched in that rock that I couldn't pull it out. Even if I wanted to, I'd have to apply some violence to it. But yet, you know, it's this glimpse of something that is unfolding in a time that is almost unfathomable to us. We can only know it in the abstract. But I just feel that the more we can learn to see ourselves in relation to that kind of depth of time and slowness of time, perhaps the more connected we would feel to the world around us, rather than this hysterical need to be out and about and to endanger each other in a pandemic, for sure.
The way you speak is so much like the way you write in terms of associations. You know, you weave in all kinds of notions and background and histories and places and artists and thinkers and writers. And I have two questions about this. One is, what's the value to the reader of invoking other people's work in this kind of way? And secondly, what does it say about your own internal working process?
Well, you know, sometimes I find myself drawn to things that I don't understand or that maybe repel me a little bit at first. You know, Morton Feldman's music isn't exactly the thing that one hears it for the first time and goes, oh yeah, I've been waiting for this forever. You know, one learns by, you know, 1,000 insinuations of an idea. But I remember just when I started listening to Feldman's work about the time I was listening to Gudnadottir, her work. And I had gone to an art show by a young French-Canadian artist, Yelena Berenc. And she had a book of 10,000 days that she was making, in which she made a mark every day for 10,000 days, or intended to, and was binding it into a single book. I mean, what is it to look at 10,000 days of marks? I mean, it is, it's a daunting task in the first case, and yeah, it is this vast work on the other physical thing in front of you. And she had only been doing it for a few years at that time. But, you know, I was gaming it out, and she would make the last mark, I think, maybe in her 37th year, which isn't, you know, that's not too many years, finally. But the work that really caught my attention, and that made this point about time, was she was a new mother. And, you know, mothers have a hard time making art often, because they have so many things to take care of in the household. And not least of all, their child. And she had struck on a brilliant idea, I think, and that was drawing, while her child napped, to sit with her child and draw the child's breath. Just make a mark that lasted the duration of a breath. And I found that so arresting and beautiful, and so placed and located in life, but it was a kind of time that so few of us ever take to pay attention. All those writers as well, it finally had a cumulative effect on me. You might say an accretion of effects on me. I woke up to what I was wanting to be aware of, to witness in the world around me, but that we have so few cultural cues that give us the permission to do that. So I think it has increasingly become a part of my own process, seeing as far into time and history as I possibly can. I inevitably fail.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with David Axelrod about his prose collection, The Eclipse I Call Father, Essays on Absence. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast. You toggle us between your adult and child selves. How would you describe the nature of your childhood? You know, the physical space, the dream space, and how do you exist in relation to those spaces now?
This is very personal. It's funny because some of the essays, personal essays, very personal essays in the collection weren't in there. They asked me to add things about my father and my family and race. So I added some things they didn't like. They didn't like my essay on the fascist architecture of the Oregon Capitol building.
Oh, wow.
That didn't make it into the book, but
wow.
as to the question you asked, I should say a few things about that. My childhood was marked very early on by violent trauma, the death of my father as basically a child himself, and that was probably the most important thing that maybe ever happened to me. We lived in a little house right at the edge of town, and there were marshes and forests that spread from that place. My mother became very depressed, and so from the age of about 4 to maybe 8 or 9, when my grandparents finally intervened and took me away, I was pretty much on my own, and spent a lot of time wandering in solitude, and with all the consequences of, you know, that come of that, of having vivid conversations with myself and a whole host of friends who were imaginary. But that forest and the places in it that I found and where I would go, the things I would do there, those were very, very fundamental experiences in shaping my own work as an adult. And I had a beloved grandfather who took me in hand and walked me everywhere in what you might call the natural world. In Ohio, that was an entirely post-industrial world that had been covered over by scrublands and second growth forests. But he would see that landscape through the eyes of someone who came of age as a young man during the Great Depression, who as a child grew up in Eastern European, Southern European black ghettos, where the language was just off the charts, fascinating and crazy, and brought him a tremendous amount of delight. And he also knew people who had a memory of that landscape from the Civil War and before. And so there were all these places where we went where I could live in the imagination, his imagination, his memory, and the memories and imaginations of those who had lived, who I never met, whose names maybe were on road signs, but it brought this sense of depth and intimacy of people and things that had unfolded there in the 19th century anyway, and certainly in the immigrant 20th century, up to the time when I left Ohio, when basically the industries that had built the place that I lived disappeared or were scaled back. There was also this agrarian connection to the world through my maternal grandmother, so that I was able to visit places on the weekends especially, but throughout the summer, where my grandfather was in no hurry to be social with others, and he sort of respected my my enjoyment of solitude. And so we would spend long, quiet afternoons, summer and fall, spring, summer and fall, even in the winter, just being quiet in a place together and watching what visited us there, far from other people. And that really comes into focus, I suppose, in that essay, To Live As We Dream, because we often dream of those places. I know I've often dreamed of those places he and I went, places like my cousin's playhouse, which was astonishing, really. It was like a miniature adult world for us. Those things are so much, I think, what probably led me to writing lyric poetry, because the dream of a lyric poem, the dream voice of a lyric poem, the dream voice of a lyric essay, so much reaches into that same sphere of being and experience that I knew as a child.
Yeah. David, I was thinking about that place of landscape and memory and time. And I was actually, it got me thinking about your essay, The Old Marriage. And I was hoping that you would read a passage from it.
One of the most difficult days of certainly my life, married life, was the day my wife and our infant drove out of Montana in August, I think, of 83, 84. There wasn't really anything that we could keep doing here. The economy was in shambles, and Missoula was quite a different place. But over the years, we were just haunted by that day, our memories of the place, and it was very difficult to feel always divided, always comparing where we were to where we wished to be, and so on and so forth. At some point, we tried to tell ourselves we had to stop. It hasn't until we came back this in January to stay. But here's the passage. For years, I wished to return to Montana, to Talking Water Creek, a small tributary to Flathead Lake, where my real life began when I married a foreign-looking girl. That return has never come, And despite occasional visits, we never surpassed the borderlands of our fatalism until late one winter afternoon when we were skiing along a trail in the Wallowa Mountains near Salt Creek Summit and looked out across Hell's Canyon eastward to the Seven Devils and the Idaho Massif, on the far eastern edge of which the mountains descend into Montana. We could see it there, almost. I permitted myself the privilege, anyway, of imagining that we could see it, where violet demarcated the onset of twilight. I felt a moment's amnesty from the little injuries that salted my blood with shame. Shame at the fact that we knew we'd failed to find our way back to the life we began there, years before we came to Oregon. Shame because we might never return, but remain always an absence among those other lives we imagined went on, happier and more successful than ours, like H's and N's, two people from Missoula, whose lives we were a part of once. Shame for the Michael Fury-like delusion that we had lost something we couldn't recover. We returned not to Montana, but to a grove in our minds, our own Blue Musulum, under a high canopy of ponderosas, dry snow stirring into whirlwinds, the heavy boughs swaying, and the entire landscape falling silent at the sky's granite edge. Yeah, so that is referring obliquely to one of my professors at the U of M when I was a very young man, Hank Harrington and his wife Nancy, and how Hank basically led me in a room full of others through all of Joyce, from the stories through Ulysses, and finally we all read Finnegan's Wake together, which was an amazing experience. Who's referred to there at the end.
David, what has it been like then to return? You've returned to Montana, but you've returned during a pandemic where you're quarantined, essentially. So do you get any sense of celebration?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure that celebration is what I'm after.
Yeah.
But I have been, given where we're living and given the kind of solitude we're living in now, and the few kinds of relationships we've been able to forge here along our road with our neighbors, very different than what we expected. We expected a much more urban, public kind of experience. But simultaneously, there are things I've longed to be witness to again, to see if, in fact, my memory of them was colored by nostalgia. And I'm here to say no, that I've been able to, for example, walk in seas of balsam root, and so many flowers I remember, and the birds are so many. They come, hundreds of birds every day come to our house and are here. We saw a bear yesterday. we've been able to plant and transplant so many things here that will, I hope, someday become an oasis. And so the crisis that we're living through separately together has been an opportunity to really spend time outside of that more pressing consumptive time to make a future.
David, I have one last question for you. At the end of the essay, Boxing Lessons, you write, "I vowed to allow no one and nothing to pass from this life without praise, even if I must praise the most bewildering losses." How does that praise look and feel to you and sound in May of 2020?
Maybe, yeah, I feel it more keenly than ever. That's for sure. My daughter-in-law's grandmother died of COVID. And we didn't know her very well. She was a Chinese writer. Her works don't have been translated into English. And yet I was writing about her in response to that horribly callous and stupid thing the lieutenant governor of Texas said, that there are things more important than living. And as I responded to that, as I worked my way toward erecting a shrine toward this woman, for this woman, that we didn't know well, but who died because of the callousness and carelessness of others, I revisited all the things on this mountainside we're living on now that aren't as important to the lieutenant governor of Texas. And yeah, I feel that the more we can name, the more we can be aware of, the more likely there's a future. If we erase everything, we become like those in Lydia Yuknovich's novel, The Book of Joan, who live in outer space, the elites in outer space, who have erased basically everything they possibly can, but their hunger for what they can steal from Earth. And that's a horrible vision, but it's one that we actually are poised against. And so I feel that urgency that I talk about there at the end of that essay about Muhammad Ali. I feel more strongly about that than ever.
David Axelrod recently returned to Missoula, Montana. He's the author of 6 collections of poetry and co-directs the Low Residency MFA program at Eastern Oregon University. Look for more information about him and his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook page at mtpr.org.